Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. I'm your New Books Network host, Cynthia Horn, and we are talking today with Dr. Nancy Adler, professor of memory, history, and transitional justice at the Neo Institute for War, Holocaust, and Genocide Studies and the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Hello, Dr. Adler. Thank you for agreeing to talk with me about your recent edited volume with Dr. Anton Weiss-Wendt. It is more timely than ever.
Good morning, Dr. Horn. It's very nice to be invited to this program to be able to talk about what we consider an unfortunately very timely book.
By way of introduction, Dr. Nancy Adler is professor of memory, history, and transitional justice, a chair established by the NIOD, the University of Amsterdam, and the Royal Netherlands Academy of Arts and Sciences. Dr. Adler teaches in the MA program on Holocaust and Genocide Studies at the University of Amsterdam and supervises PhD and postdoctoral research. Dr. Adler currently serves on the Academic Advisory Board of the Simon Wiesenthal Institute, the International Advisory Board for the Journal for Genocide Research, the Steering Committee of the Historical Dialogues, Justice and Memory Network, and is chairman of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. She has authored or edited
chairman of the Academic Working Group.
Excuse me. It's all so impressive to our readers and listeners. She has authored or edited many peer-reviewed articles, chapters, books, and volumes on transitional justice and memory. Here I highlight just a few. Keeping Faith with the Party, Communist Believers Return from the Gulag in 2012. The Gulag Survivor, Beyond the Soviet System in 2002. Victims of Soviet Terror, The Story of the Memorial Movement, 1993. Understanding the Age of Transitional Justice, Crimes, Courts, Commissions, and Chronicling in 2018. And with Selma Laisdorf, I might have gotten that wrong, Tapestry of Memory in 2013, just to name a few. It is her recent co-edited book with Dr. Anton Weiss-Wendt, The Future of the Soviet Past, The Politics of History in Putin's Russia in 2021, to which we turn our attention today with much joy. So to start, this volume is dedicated to the legacy of Arseniy Roginsky, one of the founders of Memorial. Can you tell the readers a bit about how his work with Memorial has informed your scholarly studies and research questions?
Thanks so much for starting with that question. Indeed, he's been a very significant figure in my life as a researcher and actually as a human being. I met him in 1989 at Memorial's first international oral history conference. As you said, he was founder of Memorial, chairman of Memorial. He was also a former dissident, a former prisoner, was born in the Gulag zone. I met him in 1989, but actually I first heard of him in 1981. I was a student at Barnard, and he was arrested then for forging papers to get into an archive. And Columbia at the time tried to hire him as a visiting professor so that he could avoid being incarcerated. It didn't work, but I remember very clearly the story of Arseny Raginsky in 1981. And he was sent to the Gulag, 5 camps in 4 years. He got out in 1985 and started to gather materials and regroup with the former dissidents in what would later become Memorial, Victims of Stalinism, manuscripts on the Soviet terror. So when we met in 1989 at this oral history conference, I have a photo I love to show my students about how not to take an interview. And we're standing in the hall of the Historical Archive Institute in Moscow. And I'm intimidated. I'm also very happy to be able to be interviewing this this great man. And I've got a heavy Marantz tape recorder on my arm, and I've got a notepad on top of it. I'm trying to take notes, and he's standing in front of me eating an ice cream, sort of like, you know, okay, what are you doing here, and what do you know about our history? We progressed significantly after that. Since 1989, I probably went to Moscow every year, more than once. We talked about Memorial. We talked about his personal history. He invited me to two conferences sponsored by the Yeltsin Fund on the history of approaches to Stalinism. I had him in several events at our institute in Amsterdam. He really became a guide, a mentor. And he taught so much to me about what was emerging as civil society in those days. He was deeply influential, well, not just for me, but also for most of civil society. And one of the very important points that he made was that it was easy to talk, at a certain point, it was easy to talk about victims and about crimes, but not about perpetrators. And it really became one of his life's mission to try to bring that consciousness of what the Soviet leaders, the 20th century Soviet leaders, did to their own people into public consciousness. So he tried that. He also fought from the beginning for the survival of Memorial. And in our last interview in 2016, he said, well, it wouldn't be hard to liquidate Memorial. They could just kill us with fines. The state had been trying to financially choke Memorial. And so Memorial obviously ended up being choked with fines and choked with legislation. And just to finish on this point with Roginsky, and probably I'll return to him later, I have very mixed feelings about the great honor that Memorial was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, co-awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2022. I'm very sad that he was not here to see it, but it also coincided exactly with the ending of Memorial. In fact, on the day the prize was granted, they were at a Moscow court fighting with the authorities to keep the building that was their own property. So there's also a side of me that is glad that he didn't live to see that.
Wow, that is so moving. I have to say, I have goosebumps just thinking about his impact. And we're going to come back to this theme of international influence being labeled foreign agents, right? The othering of attempts to name the perpetrators, not just acknowledge the victims. So thank you so much for sharing that with me today.
I can't promise I won't return to Braginsky himself. He tends to come up a lot.
That's great. So let's turn directly to the volume and the chapters in particular. We see Stalinism playing a central role. It's treated as more than Stalin the person. It encompasses his larger legacies. Can you elaborate a bit on the use of Stalin and Stalinism in this volume as a historical, political, and sociological concept?
Indeed. That was also, in fact, a question of the referees who peer-reviewed the manuscript. And that's why we did a little more explicit thinking about this. We consider that Stalinism is the default authoritarian political culture, not indeed just the personal evil of Stalin, but actually the larger phenomenon, the system. And one could argue, as we do, and as I think the contributions do, that this could be observed from the very beginning of the Soviet period until the end. And arguably, its consequences are deeply entrenched today. So this was the definition, the Memorial definition of Stalinism, and we adapted it because we found it entirely appropriate. And sometimes it's conflated with the crimes of the Soviet past, and sometimes it is just the crimes of Stalinism. That's a bit of a separate issue, but I think it's much more helpful to think of Stalinism in the broadest sense of the word.
Fantastic. I think that helps direct the reader as they're thinking about each of the chapters and the way they come together, since there is a blending of Stalin the person and Stalin the institution. You note in the introduction the revival of all things Soviet and many things Stalin under Putin. I was very surprised to see the increase in national popularity of Stalin over the past few years. You note that in 2016, approximately 40% of people rated the Stalin era more good than bad. And in 2017, 46% reviewed him with respect and enthusiasm. This blew me away, these increasing numbers. I would like to dig into this a little bit. I'd like to explore some of the top-down and bottom-up processes that are tapping into Stalinism and contributing to the revival and repurposing of this glorified past. So maybe to start, it is well noted that Putin has emphasized certain enduring Soviet legacies and elements of Stalinism to advance his state rebuilding efforts. But the pro-Stalin narrative is not monolithic, and I think that might come as a surprise to some readers. You note that there have been government efforts to tap down elements of Stalinism, including efforts by Medvedev and the Russian Duma. We also see the opening of a Gulag museum over this time period, draft proposals against the revival of Stalinism, and efforts to memorialize victims, including Putin's own inauguration of the Wall of Grief in Moscow to victims of Stalinism, which almost feels ironic at this point. Can you help us make some sense of the internal divisions over memory within the Russian state leadership?
You are right to point to the ambiguities. There are many, indeed. For example, at the same time, a pro-Stalin propaganda was criminalized. One could easily see Stalin's face on buses and increasing number of statues. The state used Stalin where it was helpful. So in some of these surveys where we see his popularity increasing, we can also see more specific questions that were directed at, for example, that the accomplishments under Stalin were considered more important than the losses or the excesses. So the message somehow was getting across, considering what the polls were saying about his increasing popularity. Now, the state continued something that was an old Soviet practice. If I go back for a moment to the early days of Memorial, they had a lot of trouble from the Soviet regime. And I found proceedings from a 1988 Politburo meeting where Gorbachev said, "What is this Memorial?" He was afraid that the story of the past was going to get out of control of the hands of the party. So he wanted to keep Memorial limited to regional divisions under party control. Fast forwarding to Putin taking over, let's say co-opting the memory of Stalinism, the monument, the large monument in Moscow to victims of Stalinism, on the sign in front of it, it says, "Thanks to Vladimir Putin." And it doesn't talk about perpetrators. What's on the plaque is as if it were a natural catastrophe. It is the state taking control of the narrative. So it limits what the discussion will include. And I have to say that's also true. You mentioned the Gulag Museum. Now, the Gulag Museum is quite impressive indeed. It's Moscow City-sponsored, state-sponsored. It does have a lot of important, let's say, information about individual victims. It doesn't really suggest that anything about past human rights violations being linked to present human rights violations. So it's a controlled narrative that does recognize victims. As I said, victims are allowed to be recognized as long as you don't get too far into the as long as you don't get into the perpetrator discussion, period. Now, there's been a change in this narrative. Around 2005, the state started taking increasing control of the narrative when Putin said the collapse of the Soviet Union is the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. After that, in 2008, textbooks had to start being refashioned for a different image of Stalin. Let's focus on what we did in the 1930s, not on the crimes of the 30s, but the accomplishments, the industrialization, the eradication of illiteracy. And, of course, when we look to the 40s, we're going to look to victory in the Second World War, in the Great Patriotic War. So the state has... the state cracked down on Memorial and at the same time took over elements of remembering Stalinism. It was a simultaneous process. Medvedev, who was president from 2008 to 2012, was willing to have to help, let's say, allow a database on victims of Stalinism, but absolutely not any judgment on Stalinism, because he said, who would be in a position to judge that? No president or court. So the state has had has not ignored it. They've done something that's much more sinister. They've co-opted it, this memory.
It seems like a risky strategy, because you allow parts of the memory and you're hoping to co-opt and control it. It's almost a little like a Pandora's box, though.
It is a Pandora's box. And it is risky, but not entirely risky, because the control can go so far as to close an organization that has been the most authoritative source on the crimes of Stalinism. And that is a way to take complete control. For example, the archive, the Memorial archive, thousands of dossiers on victims of Stalinism. It's not clear what the government crackdown will mean for that. So you can actually control history. You can't control what we know. And of course, there's the internet, but you can also, you can arrest historians, you can assassinate journalists. There are very, very sinister ways of keeping a lid on history. And we're seeing a lot of those being implemented right now.
How diabolically savvy of Putin to get his name on the recognition while erasing agency. One has to appreciate the significant involvement of Putin himself in this national narrative reconstruction. So we've talked a bit about the state. I found myself getting pulled into the state discussion. The bottom-up forces also contribute to this revival and repurpose. Authors in the volume detail the role of civil society groups like the Night Wolves, the popular use of Stalinist images on cars, and depictions of Stalin in cinema and theater, not just internationally, but domestically. The Orthodox Church has played an outsized role in the process of reviving a certain interpretation of the past. What are some of the unexpected findings from the volume in terms of civil society actors and forces engaged in a revival of certain memories of the past?
Well, a couple of things. Let me start with some of the unexpected findings. Some of the unexpected findings were actually that it became quite difficult for us to hold on to some of our original authors because of the political situation. That was, I guess, the most unexpected finding that we had. We learned more and more about the crackdown through that. This book was originally, it emerged from a conference that my colleague Anton Weisswendt held in 2016 called The Future of the Soviet Past. And he invited me as keynote speaker at that conference because I had written a 2005 article entitled The Future of the Soviet Past Remains Unpredictable. When I wrote that article in 2005, there were some hopeful trends. And by the time of the conference in 2016, we saw a reversal of many of them. Now, at the conference, just one of the speakers who was going to be a contributor to the volume was very upset with something I said in my keynote. And it was one of the things that I just mentioned now about Putin's famous 2005 collapse of the Soviet Union statement. This conference guests said that we'll try to refashion that narrative and explain that Putin really was referring to the Russian-speaking peoples in different parts of the former Soviet Union, how they were being discriminated against. Anyway, we were faced with a great dilemma right there about all of the forces, even from very respected historians, that were at play. We also had some of our historians pull out of fear for their jobs. Others were not allowed to travel to Russia after they started working with us. And of course, one of our authors was from Memorial itself. So by the time the volume came out, which was the end of last year, they were already actually liquidated. So there were some unexpected findings that were directly related to putting together the volume. You mentioned the Orthodox Church and its outsized role. And if I go back to Putin standing there at the Wall of Sorrow, at the monument, at opening day, he's standing there next to Patriarch Kirill, very symbolic with the church's blessing. He's opening this monument. And why does it work for the church? Why is the church such a powerful ally in this? Because the church is reinforcing the narrative of martyrs, that everyone was a victim. So the church makes it very safe for to exclude the discussion on perpetrators.
How interesting. We of course see a significant role for the church in Putin's war in Ukraine today as well.
Indeed, we do. And as I said, they are allied in this image of martyrs and victims and, well, being under attack, in fact.
Yeah. The chapter that engages the night wolves is particularly interesting to, I think our readers might find, our listeners might find that interesting. Your opening chapter starts with a Russian aphorism that I just couldn't resist. It's easy to talk about the present and future, but the past changes every day. Now, this one is delicious in many ways because it is a traditional Russian aphorism. And so I love this image about the usability and malleability of history. You also suggest the history of the Soviet past is a battleground in Russia today with contending forces. The volume explores elements of this, the way the Soviet past is actively refashioned, repurposed, and or discarded if it doesn't fit. At some points, you talk about fashioning a, quote, good future from a, quote, bad past. In some chapters, the authors illustrate efforts to expunge memories of repression, so not just not acknowledge them, but actively undermine those memories. In others, there's a reoccurrence of themes of triumph and victory from the past. Can you elaborate a bit on which components of the past are particular points of contestation and what that means for Russia today?
Yeah, very good and very complex question. Of course, Russia is one of the, or post-Soviet Russia is one of the most prominent non-cases of transitional justice. Roughly speaking, transitional justice tries to create a good future out of a bad past by confronting the past through some array of legal and non-legal measures. In Russia, this was not done. The only mechanism that even came close to actually recognizing past crimes was rehabilitation. It was a law that was put in place in 1991 after the fall of the Soviet Union that would allow victims to be exonerated, to be cleared for crimes that they did not commit, and then they could get a few paltry privileges. So this kind of non-admission of guilt was the only transitional justice mechanism. So the past had to be reconceptualized. The bad past had to become a bright past. And that means, as I alluded to before, when we look to the 30s, we don't focus on the terror of the 30s. We don't focus on the 750,000 that were executed between 37 and 38. We don't focus on the millions that languished in the gulag. No, we focus on what they were building, the great projects. We don't focus on the dead roads that led nowhere and have prisoners' bones buried under them. We focus on the projects that led to great industrialization and the mining of nickel and gold, and that narrative of triumph over the uninhabitable wilderness. And then there's the narrative of the victory. The narrative of the victory in the Second World War, in the Great Patriotic War, good against evil, became a unifying force. And it was easy to rally around that because that was heroism. And that would be something that became a real any other interpretation than the interpretation that the current regime wanted in the textbooks would become absolutely illegal. So from 2008 on, textbooks started to be refashioned to basically whitewash the crimes of Stalinism, to whitewash Stalin, to whitewash the Gulag, and to give a different way of interpreting those events. And teachers were instructed how to do that. Now, that's not to say that all teachers taught this. There was some freedom to teach what they wanted to teach, but many of them were also trained in the Soviet era. So they were acculturated to those narratives and to those norms. Putin did try to create a unified textbook that would focus on Russia being a great country with a great past, and that would be the narrative. The unified textbook did not end up coming to fruition, but there are several, and the most standard works they instruct teachers and they instruct pupils on how to remember the past. And indeed, the memory of the repression is not emphasized.
Interesting. I very much appreciate our discussion here about the history textbook revisions as in some ways they can be used as tools of transitional justice to correct wrongs in the past by being accountable, recognizing and being accountable. But at the same time, they also allow for strategic instrumentalization of the past and a rewriting of those historical narratives. I can only imagine how much history textbook revision is going on right now regarding Ukraine and Russia's longstanding history with each other.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, textbooks would be a very useful tool as a transitional justice mechanism. If we decide, okay, it's you know, a trial, much too complicated to even think of a trial and truth commissions and most of those implicated are no longer alive. Textbooks would have been an important means. Yeah, that's obviously going to be used to achieve quite the opposite end.
The thinking a little bit more about certain historical moments and memories, the book touches on central themes of anti-Nazism and the cult of the Great Patriotic War, as you've mentioned, as important and central to Russia's self-image and also the redesign of its self-image in light of the worst thing that's ever happened to Russia, the fall of the Soviet Union. In particular, the centrality of the Soviet victory over Nazi Germany is reoccurring in this volume, and it just leapt out at me as so important and timely for our understanding of Russia's relationship with Ukraine today. In particular, I was drawn to Kopasov's chapter in which he explores Article 354.1, the so-called law against the glorification of Nazism, and Pfefferman's chapter, which explores the memory of the Holocaust and Russia's efforts to prevent Holocaust denial in, again, another almost ironic turn of the way Russia has co-opted these historical narratives. In short, there is a significant and consistent engagement with anti-Nazism in the creation of Russia's self-image. Putin has used some of this rhetoric in the current war in Ukraine, talking about denazification and revisiting Ukraine's complicity with Germany during World War II, among others. Can you talk a little bit about how this historical memory in particular is used by Russia today?
Well, what we are increasingly seeing is that the state has become the Ministry of Truth. These memory laws and historical commissions that are dictating how we are to remember the past, and on pain of incarceration if we want to remember it in any other way. This has been coming for years. We should have seen the warning signals. We should have seen that the memory wars could turn into real wars. We didn't see it coming, but we could have. Even, let's say, in 2016, the director of the Russian State Archive was demoted for publishing a document that debunked the myth of the heroic stance of the Soviets in Moscow against the Nazis, Pamphilov's army. And by trying to analyze what actually happened instead of the myth of what happened was a very dangerous thing to do. When Memorial lost their appeal in February of this year, the court said that Memorial was involved in around this law, also around the foreign agent law, but around this law, that they were fabricating history around Nazism and Stalinism. And the prosecutor said their appeal was rejected. And the prosecutor said an organization tasked with pursuing the historical truth and honoring the memory of victims of political repression now aimed to falsify history and transform public consciousness from one that remembers the victors to one that repents for the crimes of the Soviet past. So any discussion, any equivocation of Nazism with Stalinism was starting to be criminalized. This was also one of the reasons that Memorial was allowed to be shut down. On the 80th anniversary of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, just a few years ago, Putin said this was the only strategically possible step, and it was deft diplomacy. We could see that coming. The falsification of history was already enshrined in a commission in 2009 under Medvedev that would review anything that would bring that would show Russia in an unfavorable light. And this has been gaining momentum. We just didn't think it was as dangerous as it ended up being. And we always knew that history was deeply politicized. And if I come back to my first interviews with Arseniy Raginsky, when Memorial was just emerging, he said, no, we're not a political organization. We're a historical organization. Because the minute you get that label of a political organization, they really were not allowed to exist as such. And this ended up being kind of the crux of the battle with the government, that the government insisted that they were a political organization rather than historical organization. And in fact, history is politics, especially when you're trying to suppress so much of it. And I have to come back to that definition of Stalinism. There's such an entrenched culture of repression in post-Soviet Russia that this has been made all the more possible. We mentioned transitional justice. There was a single opportunity, actually, just after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1992, which, according to Sergei Kovalyov, whom I interviewed, he was Yeltsin's human rights commissioner and also a former Gulag prisoner. He was a former dissident. He was the only only former dissident who rose to a very high political position. He told me that that could have been the Russian Nuremberg judging the crimes of communism. It was about the constitutionality of a ban on the Communist Party. It never got beyond the issue at hand, so it failed completely in its mission and in any larger mission that could have been conceivable. So what we had is a society that since the fall of since the end of a 70-year dictatorship, which claimed probably about, conservatively estimated at 12 million lives, not actually doing anything to properly confront the past and cracking down on grassroots organizations. And what's happening today in Ukraine shouldn't actually surprise any of us if we've been listening for the last 15 years since 2005. It's a great country with a great past. Reconceptualizing history to make this something that, you know, let's say Russia under attack, Russians under attack, we have to come in and save them. So this is, and cracking down on the media and censorship is also one way of keeping the public at least at a distance, or making the public understand that it's not really safe to resist right now.
Bill, kind of building on this connection with Ukraine and our discussion about anti-Nazism, I think it took some people by surprise when Putin was using this denazification rhetoric to justify assault on Ukraine. But it sounds like if we had been paying attention to what was happening in Russia for the prior 15 years, we shouldn't have been surprised.
Yeah, in a certain sense, it's Soviet speak. I mean, you could say black is white or white is black, and that's just the way it is. There were very early, old Bolsheviks who believed in the party so firmly that they would believe anything that the party said. In a certain sense, that is at least what the current regime is trying to do. In 2015. I saw an exhibition at the Museum of the Revolution, and it said Crimea, the story of its return, the story of its return. So kind of the heroic story of its return. You can take any narrative and reconceptualize it. As I said, if the bright future never arrived, because communism always promised a bright future, you can reconceptualize and change it into a bright past. Well, that bright future that communism was building on didn't arrive. But look at all we have done, and so this is what's happening today. History is being instrumentalized and abused. History is being abused. The rhetoric, the anti-Nazi rhetoric regarding Ukraine is something that can only hold water because they are trying to completely control all channels of information regarding that. And I actually have understood, again, that some of my even very respected historian friends in Russia do subscribe to some of this stance. It's they're being flooded with misinformation, but there are still a lot of forces. If I can come back to Memorial, where I started, just because they've been eliminated, liquidated, and just because of the crackdown doesn't mean they'll stop their work. They're dissidents, they're survivors, they're fighters. And they will also continue to try to expose the truth about past human rights violations and about present human rights violations. So in a certain sense, knowing the individuals I know and knowing the forces of civil society that I've come to know in the last 35 years, I have a little glimmer of hope in this very, very, very dark time for post-Soviet Russia.
That's very nice to hear, especially after marinating in some of this, not just the legacies of Stalin, but the current repurposing. I think this also helps listeners to understand why an argument about denazification is seen as virtuous and resonates positively in Russian society. So on my last question is to ask you to think a little bit about how the volume potentially informs the current conflict in Ukraine. You mentioned Crimea. I'm thinking here about not just Russia's annexation of Crimea, but its decade-long targeted destabilization of Ukraine's east. You mentioned Russia saying it needed to go into to save Russian citizens in the East were being persecuted. We even saw Putin use the word genocide against Russian citizens in a twist of the term here. And also bringing it back to Russia's more aggressive posturing with the West over the past couple decades, linking maybe that to Putin's great regret about the fall of the Soviet Union. Can you comment a little for us about how the most recent Russian invasion fits with its ongoing patterns of managing and manipulating the past?
You know, in a certain sense, even though I said we could have predicted it, it didn't fully fit. I mean, such aggressive posturing didn't fully fit. It did seem that it was mostly going to be about words and about marginalizing peoples and about textbooks and about not giving proper recognition, not properly recognizing past crimes. It seemed that the pattern would just kind of continue on with that. I can also say, as we're having this conversation, that I have to think back rather heartbreakingly, actually, to my interviews in the mid-90s with Gulag survivors who then were in their 80s and who were 90-plus. And they said that their hope was with the first graders at that time. So they were, you know, kids who were, let's say, 6 or 7, who are today in their late 20s. And what a tremendous disconnect that ended up being, because it's exactly these groups that seem to be following Putinism and joining patriotic movements and supporting a greater Russia with a great past, and seeing Ukraine as an enemy and seeing Russia as entitled to do this, to defend its interests, because, you know, the victor in the Great Patriotic War and the greatest anti-Nazi force on earth, and never compare Nazism with Stalinism. And if I think back on these Gulag returnees who were so certain that that group, born into a free Russia, he said it would take a generation. So here we are a generation later, and such a tremendous reversal in our expectations. And I can say as analysts, and I'm sure I speak for all the colleagues of the volume and for my co-editor, Anselm Weiss-Wendt, that there were a couple of moments that we thought we could have seen coming, but did not see coming. That was the collapse of the Soviet Union. That's this trend that we've signaled since 2005. The liquidation of Memorial, as I said, I spoke with the chairman already in 2016. He said it just wouldn't be all that hard. But seeing locked doors on the headquarters and again, arrested historians. Historians arrested for delving into the Nazi past of some Soviet citizens. There's part of it that remains unfathomable, even for someone who spent 35 years trying to analyze this.
Well, I feel like yours is a message of hope. And I like that as the way to maybe wrap up our podcast.
I would like to think that we are leaving with a glimmer of hope, again, precisely because of those very strong civil society forces that will not leave Russia, most of them, and will not be disbanded, even if they don't have any real place to be doing their work together.
Well, Dr. Adler, thank you so much for your insights. This book is more timely than ever as we see the way history and memory are being actively used by Putin in his war in Ukraine. So it is been so helpful to our readers or to our listeners. The book again, The Future of the Soviet Past, The Politics of History in Putin's Russia. I strongly encourage you to read it. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Horn, for your careful reading and your great questions. Really appreciate it. Also on behalf of my co-editor, Anton Weisvent.
Fantastic. Thank you.